The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the Upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Good morning. My name is Brian. I'm really glad to be able to celebrate with you this morning to open up the Word. I'm going to invite you to think well with me this morning, really well, because I've been given a lot of narrative to cover. We're going to cover almost, 2.5 chapters this morning. And so we're going to be reading narrative. Narratives are where there's an account of something that actually happened. And so I'm going to walk through this narrative with you. It's important when we think about narrative to realize this is real people, real experiences with God in real ways. So I'm going to walk you through that, kind of be the tour guide through that narrative and pointing out things to you in the narrative. And then when we come to the end, we're going to try to draw our minds and hearts around why tell us this particular narrative. Now, before we begin the narrative, there is something that I want you to understand. There are times when we read Old Testament narratives, and it actually happens when we read Gospels sometimes, we read about the person who's going through a certain kind of experience. And we can sometimes ding the person. We can say, well, they missed it. They should have seen that. They should have known. We do that with the disciples. When the disciples are growing in their relationship with Jesus and they seem to have questions, we go, hey, don't you guys know that? We've read the whole gospel. They're living in the midst of it, and hence they don't know stuff that we know, and it's easy for us to ding them, to chastise them for having not understood what was going on. I think, for example, Abraham's journey in Genesis chapter 12, when God has called him from Ur and he tells Abraham, I'm going to take you to the land that I'm going to show you. It'll be the land of promise. And as you read Abraham's narrative, you understand that he goes up to Haran and then comes down from Haran and travels through the promised land and goes all the way to Egypt. And I've heard Bible teachers say, he should have stopped there. Well, God hadn't told him to stop there yet. God said, I'm going to take you to a land that I'm going to show you. And as he's traveling through Canaan, there's a famine in the land and there's a bunch of people in the land. And God says to Abraham, I'm going to give this land to your descendants. I think Abraham thought, that's a really good idea. They can have it. There's a famine here. I don't want this. And so he continues to travel through to Egypt. And it's only when he returns that God then tells him, yes, now this land, not just for your descendants, but for you. And so I think sometimes when we read narratives, we, knowing where the story is going, we conclude they missed it. But it's not always the case. They're actually on a journey. They're experiencing a growing relationship with the living God. Abraham didn't know that. The disciples sometimes don't know the things we know. And I want you to think that way as we read this narrative in Genesis. This morning, we're picking up in the book of Exodus. We're picking up in the book of Exodus as the children of Israel are making their journey out of slavery. Now, as they do that, they're going to face some challenges. It's going to be a new experience for them. It might be easy for us to critique them because we know where they're going. We know some of the story. We think they should have known better. But if you'll join me in reading the narrative, reading the account, thinking honestly about where they are and what they're struggling with, I think we might actually find something very refreshing and very encouraging and very helpful to our own lives. Now, there's a lot to cover, so we're going to take bite-sized portions, read some, think some, dwell some, and then keep on working our way through the text that I was asked to teach. So we're going to start in Exodus chapter 15. I'm picking up in verse 22. It'd be really helpful if you have a copy of the scriptures to open so you can follow along, track with me while we're tracking with the children of Israel. Exodus chapter 15. I'm going to read just the first few verses, starting in verse 22. This is after the parting of the Red Sea, after the children of Israel have been delivered from the Egyptians in that way. Verse 22. Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah, which means bitter. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. There the Lord made for them a statute and a rule, and there he tested them, saying, if you will diligently listen to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you that I put on the Egyptians, for I am Yahweh, the Lord your healer. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. Now think with me, according to Exodus chapter 12, there were 600,000 fighting men that left Egypt. That means there may be as many as 2 million people making this trip, a huge group. They're 3 days now into the wilderness. Think about the moment, right? 2 million people traveling through the wilderness. What's their concern? Where are we going to get something to drink? I mean, that's a legitimate concern. Even after what they've experienced in the plagues and the deliverance that God has done for them, this is something different. I want to suggest that although we might think they shouldn't have grumbled, it makes sense that this large group of people is now struggling with how to get water. What have they seen? They've lived in bondage for 400 years. And then they saw 10 plagues where God demonstrated his power in bringing judgment and calamity on the Egyptians. And then they watched him destroy the Egyptian army in the Red Sea. So they know God can do troubling things. But that's different than needing water. They're not sure if this God, who has been showing himself with great power, that great, he can bring plagues, we don't need plagues. He can bring destruction, we don't need destruction. What we need is water. This is a very different need. And so they begin to grumble. What are we going to drink? Where are we going to get water? And notice that the Lord did not rebuke them when they grumbled. Seems like it was a pretty legitimate concern. We need water, and they're grumbling against Moses, and the Lord responds very graciously, shows Moses a way that he is going to make the water of Marah sweet so they can drink that. He doesn't rebuke them. He does say he's going to test them in this moment. And I don't know how you think about that, but our two high school graduates, you've been through lots of tests. And I have this sneaky suspicion that sometimes when my teachers back in school would give me tests, they wanted to give me a test to prove what I didn't know. That's how it felt, right? See, they're both smiling. They know. That's not the kind of thing that God is doing. When God, it says that he's testing them, he's giving them the opportunity to learn something. It's not a test to show what they didn't know, but a test to live into what he's wanting for them. And what he wants for them is to learn that he's going to provide for them. And notice, after this moment at Marah, he takes them to a place where there's 12 springs of water. And I want to think, why didn't he start there? Why didn't he lead them to the place where there were 12 springs? Because he's leading them by a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. And he takes them to a place where there's bitter water and they grumble, and he shows himself in a particular way in that moment. So there's the first little narrative piece. They're wrestling with him, in a sense. They're wrestling on their journey. How do we understand this journey into a new kind of life? They have a legitimate need. We could use some water. They grumble, and God doesn't rebuke them, but provides for what they need. Well, let's pick up from there and pick up the next little narrative piece. It's in chapter 16, verses 1 through 8. They then set out from Elim, where those 12 springs of water were, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Keep in mind, that's 2 million people making this journey, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron on the wilderness, and the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, "At evening you shall know it is the Lord Yahweh who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. For what are we that you would grumble against us? And Moses said, when the Lord gives you in the evening meat to eat and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your grumbling that you grumble against him, what are we? Your grumbling is not against us, but against the Lord. This is a month after the Passover. So they have now traveled a month out of Egypt. It's already been a hard journey. Do you think they've got little food trucks following them, providing for them as they go along? No, we got 2 million people. They're carrying as much as they can when they leave Egypt. Now they're 30 days into it. What's happened to their food supply? It started to diminish. Now they're short on food. How much could they have taken with them from Egypt? Not so much. Then again, I think it makes sense that they begin to grumble. Their stomachs begin to rumble and their hearts begin to grumble. Notice, they grumble against Moses. It specifically says, what did they say? Ultimately, what they're feeling, they say, you brought us out here to kill us. But they're still being led by a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. What might they be thinking? I want you to feel the realness of the people in their journey, because this is an account of something that actually happened. Why might they have responded to Moses and said, you just brought us out here to kill us, even though we see the pillar? Do you think it's possible they're thinking, you've misunderstood reading those directions? That celestial GPS, you're not following it quite right, because now we're out of food. Moses, what's going on? I want you to feel how real their struggle is as they're making this journey. Don't read it like a caricature. It's people wrestling with how they're going to make this journey. And notice again, how did the Lord respond? No judgment on them. No judgment on the nation. In fact, even before Moses cries out to the Lord, the Lord speaks to him. Before Moses raises his voice, the Lord says to him, hey, I'm about to do something to let the people know I'm leading. Not you, Moses, not you, Aaron. I'm going to do something to put my glory on display. Even before Moses raised a cry to the Lord, apparently the Lord took the initiative to address the problem. In fact, notice what Moses explains. Your grumbling is not against us, it's against the Lord, not against Moses and Aaron. But the Lord had heard their grumbling and intends to respond. Notice verses 6 and 7. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it is the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against the Lord. So two things to notice there. God says, I heard your grumbling. I know you're struggling. And God takes the initiative to respond to that and says, and I'm going to show you more of my glory while you're on this journey. You will see and you will know it's me who's leading you. You will see and you will know something of my glory. So again, second little moment. They're concerned about food, and God says, I hear the grumbling. I'm going to take responsibility and take initiative to meet that need. So let's pick up the next piece, chapter 16, starting in verse 9. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling. And as soon as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. What does that mean? It means that although they've been following the cloud by day, pillar of fire by night, somehow there is a fresh display of God's glory in that cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I've heard the grumbling of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I, Yahweh, I am your God. In the evening, quail come up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what Yahweh has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as he can eat. You shall each take an omer, according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered then as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it over till morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy rest day, a Sabbath to Yahweh. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over, lay aside to be kept till the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, nor were there worms in it. And Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. Now on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, with the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Then Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. And the people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came out to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. And, in case you didn't know, an omer is a tenth part of an ephah, which is really helpful to know. It's just a measurement. So what's going on in this next episode? They're interested in more food. They need food. So describe the scene. They're concerned. They're grumbling. And God says, I understand their grumbling. I'm going to provide. And so it starts with abundant quail come one night. And it just covers the camp. And so they have enough roast chicken. Wings and thighs and whatever they can eat. So abundant quail to eat. And then comes the manna in the morning. Something miraculous. When they first saw it, they say, what is it? Now, some Bible teachers say that's where the term manna comes from, because Hebrew, the expression, what is it, would sound like mana. What is it? But I doubt that for 40 years, every time they gathered it, they go, what is it? What is it? What? I mean, you do that for a week or two, maybe. But after 20 years of doing it, I don't know that they called it, what is it? Later on in this text that we just read, it says they did call it manna. Now, there's a Hebrew word that refers to portion or provision, and it's a Hebrew word, mana. So I think they ended up calling it God's provision. When they first saw it, they said, what is it? It didn't take them long to realize, oh, this is God's provision. So they called it manna. That's the provision that the Lord is making. Describe the instruction. I mean, look at the instructions. God says, 6 days you're going to gather it, and just gather enough for the day. But did you notice that the sum, when they first started to gather it, they gathered more than they could eat for the day. And they tried to save it over till the next day. And the next day, it stank and bred worms. Now, let's be really honest. What would it be like to be part of that 2-million-person caravan traveling through the wilderness without food, and now we're 30 days into this journey, and we're desperate for food, and we get this first... What do you think it was like this first week? There's bread out in the wilderness. What would you have done? I don't think it's unreasonable to look around and go, this is wonderful. This first day, we gather enough to eat, and do we know what's going to happen tomorrow? Not quite clear, so we gather a little more to hold over to tomorrow, a few leftovers, and it turns out that it didn't go very well. What about when it says on the seventh day, Some got up and went looking. Why do you think they might have done that? Think about this. The first week this is happening, how often have they experienced this kind of provision? Not often at all. So I think that the way that they're wrestling with this, sometimes gathering more than they should, sometimes going out on the seventh day, when they're first experiencing this, they're learning what it's going to be like to trust the living God in this long journey. Don't be too hard on them. It makes sense that some might wanted to pick some up and hold on till tomorrow. It might make sense for them, if it happens six mornings this week, the seventh morning, we're going out to see if it's there or not. I think that as they're learning, they're trying to understand how it is that God is going to provide for them. When I was reading this, I was thinking about our dog. I have a dog named Bailey. She's getting very up there in years. When we first got her, we would feed her, and we'd put food down for her, and she would voraciously go after it, and then she would tend to go out in the backyard and throw it up. And we were like, what's going on with this? We talked to the vet, and the vet explained to us she probably was raised in a litter where she had to fight for food. So as soon as the food was down, she was going to eat as much of it as she possibly could. Well, we put down enough for her, but it was more than she was accustomed to eating because she didn't have to fight for it, and it just upset her stomach, and then she'd go out and toss her breakfast or lunch. And so we talked with the vet, and he explained to us what to do about that. But that kind of response, we don't have much food. We've been desperate for food. There's food out there, and I'm going to gather as much of it as I can. The Lord said, no, you don't need to do that every day. I'm going to provide. But it makes sense to me that some who are desperate for food would have gathered more until they learned, no, that's not how it's going to go. And then on the seventh day, it makes sense to me that some of them went and said, we don't know about next week, but let's see if there's any there today. And what's going on here is that for week after week after week, the Lord is doing something really intentional with the people. This provision of bread is not accidental. It's intentional. Notice, in fact, Moses' commentary, it's not part of the narrative in a sense. He's looking back and he said, this continued for 40 years, week in and week out, 6 days of gathering and resting on the Sabbath. Why call them to rest on the Sabbath? Don't take this wrong. I don't think it's because they needed to rest. They're not laboring hard. They're traveling far. But I think the rest, the seventh day of rest, was to let them know it's not magical. It's purposeful. It's intentional. God is doing this. You depend on Him. Every week, it was the same thing. 6 days you gather. Seventh day you rest. Sixth day you get double the amount and it doesn't spoil. What is that? You realize that after doing this for a month or two or three or do this for a year, that they are starting to learn something about what it means to depend on the regular provision of the Lord. I think this was purposely designed to teach them something as they're making this journey into new life. Then we get to chapter 17. Verse 1, all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages according to the commandment of the Lord and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, what shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile. And go, behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, is the Lord among us or not? So here we get another situation where they're desperate for water. Similar to before, but there's a difference here. Again, they grumbled against Moses, thinking he's led them out into the wilderness only to leave them to die. And again, Yahweh graciously provides a solution that they needed. He doesn't judge them. He provides a solution. But notice, it is said here that they tested Yahweh. They tested the Lord. What does that mean? We're given clarity about that in verse 7. Because of the quarreling of the people of Israel and because they tested Yahweh by saying, is the Lord Yahweh among us or not? That's how they were testing him. What does that mean when they say, is Yahweh among us or not? Certainly. Again, I want you to think about what the experience of the people have been. They are traveling. They're now months and months into this journey. God has provided them with water, quail, manna. They're thirsty again. He's going to provide water, but it says that they tested him, and their question was, is Yahweh among us or not? And I want to think about, honestly, what might that question be? I was thinking about a friend of mine who sadly is going through a divorce, and his desire is to provide for his wife and children. She's instituted the divorce. He's not interested in it. But nevertheless, he's providing for the family. He's providing for his wife. He's providing for the children. But the children sometimes raise a question. Is Dad here? It's not that Dad hasn't made provision. They want to know, is he present in our lives? And he's wrestling with how to live that out. I think that might be the question that the children of Israel are asking. Hey, we get manna every day. We've had water when we've needed it. And now we're thirsty again. They are learning to trust him, but their question is Yahweh here? That is he merely providing for us at arm's distance, or is he really here? And God answers in such a way to help confirm for them, yes, I am here in your midst. I haven't left you. It's not merely that I've provided for you, sent resources from heaven. I am present with you. Certainly the pillars are still there, the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. But is he here? Is he present with us? We need to know if you're still here with us, Yahweh, and the Lord shows that he, in fact, is. He actually says to Moses, I'm going to stand in front of you and show you where to strike the rock. I am present and here with you. One more snapshot. Like I said, I was given a big section of text to walk you through. Chapter 17, picking up in verse 8. Then Amalek, that's another group of people, came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun, and Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Well, what's going on here? Again, they're on a journey. They're heading towards the land that God has promised. They've had all kinds of natural challenges. This is the first kind of battle they've had to face. They didn't pick the fight. Others attacked them. And notice what's recounted in the account. They fought, but apparently the Lord was the one who was enabling the victory. He ultimately says, I've fought against Amalek. And part of the way that he did that was through Moses' participation. Moses raising his hand with his staff. And when that hand grew tired, he switched to the other hand. And when that hand grew tired, then the staff wasn't raised. And Amalek started to win, so Aaron takes one side, and Hur takes the other side, and Moses holds the staff up, and then he goes, guys, I'm switching hands, that hand's a little too tired, and Aaron and Hur hold up the hands, and ultimately God says, I'm the one that defeated Amalek, and I want you to remember that. What did the Lord want the people to remember? Write this in a memorial book and recite it in the ears of Joshua. I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek. God is the one who fought. It is the Lord who won the victory. He was going to keep them. That's what they see as this narrative unfolds. Long text, lots of pieces. How do they hang together? Let's just recap. Initially, they needed water, and the Lord provided. He said, I'm giving you the opportunity to see that you can trust me. That's the test, revealing that you can trust me. They then had a need for food, and the Lord provided. And he said he was showing them his glory, that they would know that he was the one leading them. And then he provides the manna. But as we noted, it was to underscore daily provision, regular dependence every day. And then there was, again, water provision. And again, the Lord provided for his people so that they would know, I'm here with you. I'm not just sending supplies. I am here with you. He really was with them. And then the battle. The former slaves came to know that they would be able to survive even the attack of an enemy because of the Lord's care. And they're supposed to remember this. They're supposed to write a remembrance of the battle. They're supposed to keep a collection of the manna. So what is all of this narrative about? Taken as a whole, I think this whole section, what is it that we should see? I do not think it's simply isolated nuggets, but it's actually a journey woven together with various strands, all conveying something to the Israelites and perhaps for us. I'm not suggesting that this is an allegory of the Christian life. That is, that you need to try to think about what your manna is and who your Amalekites are or what rock you need to strike in order to have God's provision. I don't think we should reduce that to an allegory. Don't read narratives that way. But there is something going on that God is orchestrating for his people as he led them, doing things for their benefit. And it's the kind of thing that he's doing that I think we can learn from. That is, it's the kind of thing he does with everyone he's drawing into a life with himself. Here's what I'd like to suggest. Like a good father or a good teacher, Yahweh is guiding and instructing his people about what it's going to look like to depend on him, something they have not yet experienced in full. He's taken them from slavery, brought them through because of the plagues and took them through the Red Sea, but they need to grow to understand what it means to depend on him, and they're going to face various needs. He's attentive to their grumbling, but he doesn't harshly rebuke them. He knows that they are learning, and he is intending to teach them. He tests them, in a sense, gives them opportunity to lean into trusting him for their good. He provides what they need in a daily, regular way, so they develop a habit of looking to him moment by moment, day by day. They learn greater dependence. I know that some read these sections and conclude that Israel kept messing up. They just should have known better. They were rebellious. But I don't actually see that in what's going on. I see them wrestling honestly with where they are in life. I see them wrestling with not knowing where things are going, but somehow the Lord is leading us. I see them learning to walk into a new life with the Lord who rescued them that they haven't yet experienced. They're taking baby steps. And here's the sweet thing. He's okay with them learning. He's okay with them not fully understanding how he's going to provide. He's even okay with their grumbling. Hey, okay, you're grumbling. I understand. You're thirsty. I'm going to provide for that. I understand you're hungry. I'm going to provide for that. They have yet to experience that. That, friends, should encourage us. There are times when on your journey with the Lord that you will not know what he's doing. Ever feel that? Not know what he's doing? Not know what the future holds? You can't see your way forward. You don't know how the needs are going to be met. You're not clear where the life is headed. The truth is, dependence on the Lord can only be learned by being in a place where you have no way to make forward progress on your own. Dependence on the Lord can only be learned by being in a place where you have no way forward on your own. Trusting the Lord becomes your only option. What's the Lord orchestrating for the nation? You need to trust me. You can trust me. I'm going to teach you to trust me. And that means he's taking them. He's leading them purposely. Who took them to Marah? The Lord did. And then he provided for them. Who took them into the wilderness where they needed food? God did. And then he provides for them. who took them daily, providing manna. He did that purposely, all for the purpose of teaching them. You can trust me. Who took them to the place where the Amalekites came and fought them? The Lord did that. He orchestrated that. He led them there. And then he showed that he was the one who was going to take care of them in the midst of it. That is so encouraging to me because I know that in my long journey with the Lord, there are times when I do not see what he's doing. I know that those who are the children of God are led by the Spirit of God. So today, you woke up this morning and the Spirit of God did intend to lead you, and you all saw clearly exactly what the week was going to look like, right? You knew exactly what would unfold. You knew every challenge that you were going to face and how you were going to get through it. No, we are faced with various challenges, various struggles that we don't see our way forward. Why does the Lord orchestrate our lives that way? Because the only way to learn dependence is to be in a place where, in fact, you can't meet the need yourself. And he's not surprised then when we raise a question, go, whoa, what is going on? God's answer to that is, I'm showing you that you can depend on me. I'm teaching you what it looks like to depend on me. Notice Jesus actually teaches us to pray, give us this day our yearly bread, right? No, our monthly bread, so we can, no. Give us this day our daily bread. Well, if you actually were living every day, getting up, looking to see if the pillar has moved, and if not, then we're gathering manna because today he's going to provide for us, what would you come to experience week after week, month after month? You'd start to understand, I can depend on him in the midst of this journey. I think that's what's going on in this huge narrative. He was training them, growing them up, walking with them in life, and he always does that with those who are his. The very best thing, friends, the very best thing for us is to grow more and more dependent on him. Let me talk with you just a little bit about that. You know, we think when we're raising our children, soon high school graduates, we're raising our children. When you first bring your babies home from the hospital, they are entirely dependent on you, right? They can't eat, they can't feed themselves, they can't clothe themselves, they are entirely dependent on you. And so as that little infant is growing, you're hoping to teach that child to take some responsibility for himself, herself. So now you'll wash the clothes, but they'll still have to start to get dressed themselves, even if they put the shirt on backwards and don't know how to tie the shoes. You will prepare the food and set it in front of them and then give them a spoon and they will start to eat and you'll encourage them, you'll need to eat. And gradually what you're hoping is that there will come some interdependence, that the growth will come as they start to take some ownership for how they're going to do life. And then ultimately you send them away to college and you're hoping that, not that they won't ever contact you or they might not say, Mom, Dad, there's some need here. Can you help? You're hoping that they will grow more and more into independent living and then one day you'll launch them off and they will have their own life. And we have this notion that maturity is a move from entire dependence to through interdependence to independence. Biblical maturity is just the opposite. Before you met Jesus, you were entirely independent of life with God. You were just doing life on your own. He awakened you to new life. And what's now the journey? The journey is to grow to be more and more and more and more and more dependent on him. That's what's going on with the nation of Israel. They've gone from a place where they were enslaved, food was provided for them, they just did what they were told to do. And now he's drawing them into a life where they're going to experience greater and greater dependence on him because it's the very best thing for people who are in relationship with the living God. Here's how Jesus described it in John chapter 15. He said, I'm the vine, you are the branches, my Father is the vine dresser, and he's going to ensure that fruit's going to come from the vine. It's not about us becoming fruit bearers, doing what you can to bear fruit. No, it's a good vine. It's a good vine dresser. The Lord's intention is that you grow more and more. That's why he says, abide in me. That's a language of dependence. Abide in me. Depend on me, and there'll be fruit. this, I think, is what's going on in this narrative. Active, ongoing learning to be dependent. As the Lord did with the nation, He wants to do with us. And hence, I'm really encouraged by this narrative. It's really easy to read this and they screwed up. They screwed up. They were disobedient. They did. No. They're learning. They are growing to understand what it means to live in relationship with a God who is eternally faithful and can provide for all their needs. And He is weaning them off of their strategies and drawing them into a life of dependence. And brothers and sisters, that is God's intention for all those in relationship with Himself. An ever-growing, ever-deepening life of dependence. I'm going to pray, but I don't want just me to pray. I want you to pray. I want you to take just a couple of minutes and let the reality of this narrative drive you to think about where you're struggling with depending on Him. And then, maybe it's grumbling, but at least raise your voice to Him and tell Him you'd like to understand a bit more about what it will be like to be dependent more and more. Then I'll pray. Then we'll worship, because our God is a faithful God that we can depend on. So take just a minute and talk with Him. What a sweet reminder. Thank you, Lord, that you gave me a taste of it this morning. I've been here at Easley dozens of times to teach. And this morning I got lost. And I panicked. Didn't recognize where I was. Somehow I missed what I needed to see. I could just hear you. Trust me. I pulled off. I asked directions. I followed the directions and they were wrong. I asked you for help. You showed me what I needed to see. And I rejoiced that I could depend on you. The children of Israel are so real. Their struggles so honest and your faithfulness so good. That's what we want. We would like to grow to be the people who increasingly find ourselves dependent on you because of your faithfulness. Dependent on you because of your grace. Dependent on you because of your anticipating what our needs would be and planning ahead to meet them. Grant that we would be those kind of branches, abiding in the vine, experiencing fruitfulness, because we love to depend on you. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.